You are listening to Books Are My People, a podcast for book lovers with book news, recommendations, and ruminations on living a literary life. My name is Jennifer Calogaris, and I am recording on Wednesday, September 6th, 2023. This is episode 108. I am recently back from a hockey tournament in San Diego with my youngest. I didn't get to see much of San Diego, but I got to see a lot of hockey rinks. Shocker. We are back at school. My kids are on a new 9-day rotation. If you can imagine the confusion that it's causing all of us, I cannot keep up with two kids on two separate 9-day rotation schedules. It makes any sort of planning close to impossible. I'm going to be participating in another Instagram Live with Annie Sullivan from the online book club So This on September 19th at 9 in the morning Pacific time. So keep an eye out for that. I've put a ton of new upcycled journals in my Etsy shop. They're great to keep track of all the books you're reading or all the books you want to read or the books you've read but forgot you read them because you didn't write them down. This happens to me all the time. I'll link them up in the show notes. And I've also added some art. I've added some art stickers and some prints, and I'm going to continue to add more as I pull it together. I'm still giving away a brand new hard copy of Genevieve Gornicek's The Weaver and the Witch Queen. This is a riveting and beautiful book about friendship and sisterhood and the bonds that hold three women together. All you have to do to enter is comment on my post on Instagram. Make sure you're signed up for my weekly newsletter, Books Are My People, which comes out each Tuesday on new book release day. And you can sign up in the link in the show notes or through my Instagram account. Gain extra entries by sharing my post and tagging friends in the comments. The giveaway closes for reals on Thursday, September 14th, and I'll announce a winner on the original post on Friday, September 15th. My husband and I celebrated our 20-year anniversary a few days ago. It just blows my mind how fast time goes. We celebrated with a little getaway in Santa Monica for the night. And now it's time for some bookish news. Want to walk in the literal footsteps of your favorite writers? Some former homes of writers are open to private fans who can stay the night, including Zelda and F. Scott Fitzgerald's home in Montgomery, Alabama, where he wrote Tender is the Night, Emily Dickinson's solitary bedroom in Amherst, where she wrote almost all of her 1,800 poems. You can't stay overnight there, but you can spend $300 for 1 hour in her bedroom. Then there's Rudyard Kipling's estate in Dummerston, Vermont, although he didn't write The Jungle Book there. The desk where he wrote the book remains, and the home sleeps eight. There's even Willa Cather's childhood home in Red Cloud, Nebraska, which is the one, well, I don't know, it would be a toss-up for me between Willa Cather and Emily Dickinson. And Cather's home is open to overnight guests through an Airbnb for $140 a night. Oh wait, there's one more. Hunter S. Thompson's cabin in Woody Creek, Colorado. This is a 40-acre estate, and if you are interested, sign up now because the waitlist is more than a year long. And speaking of Hunter S. Thompson, if you live in Southern California, a Hunter S. Thompson musical is coming to the La Jolla Playhouse in October. Would I see that? I think I would. And here's a feel-good writer story. Two internet friends wrote a novel together, meeting only after they completed the project. Helen MacDonald is from England, and Shin Blanche is from Ireland, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm using Sinead O'Connor as inspiration for my pronunciation. Anyhow, they booked an Airbnb in Ireland to meet for the first time, and as MacDonald puts it, got on like a house on fire. After finishing their novel Prophet, the story of a military-designed chemical called Prophet, which draws subjects into nostalgic trance, then a catatonic state. If MacDonald's name sounds familiar, they wrote the best-selling memoir H is for Hawk, and the duo met online, chatting on Twitter about, of course, Doctor Who. Prophet was published in August, and I will link to it in the show notes. Today's guest author recommendation comes from Laura Zimmerman, the author of Just Do This One Thing for Me, which came out on August 22nd. This novel is about a rule-following daughter trying to hold her family together after her scammer mother disappears. So let's hear what Laura recommends.
This is Laura Zimmerman, the author of My Eyes Are Up Here and the new novel, Just Do This One Thing for Me. Today, I'd like to recommend Weather by Jenny Offill. A librarian finds herself the amateur psychological support for a host of strangers with questions that range from metaphysical to strikingly practical. She attempts to advise while navigating the mundanities of her own life, all against a backdrop of an unraveling country and a quickly warming planet. It's a keenly observed sketch about living simultaneously under a rising sense of urgency and a shattering feeling of powerlessness. The modern human condition is existential dread veiled by a thousand lesser anxieties. But the book is also funny. As in her earlier novels, Offill hits hard with the lightest of touches. In a spare 200 pages that are salted with scientific, literary, and philosophical references, survival tips, and classic jokes, Offill's style is like no other. Minor characters are deftly written, instantly recognizable archetypes for a modern age. She's distilled reams of subject knowledge into a savory breadcrumb trail that makes you want to read, reread, and sometimes read out loud.
And again, that's Weather by Jenny Offill. I read and loved this book and recommended it on the show on episode 17. Thanks again to Laura Zimmerman, author of Just Do This One Thing for Me, for the guest recommendation. Hannah Carlson teaches dress history and material culture at the Rhode Island School of Design. After training as a conservator of costume and textiles at the Fashion Institute of Technology, she received a PhD in material culture from Boston University. She has contributed articles to Commonplace, the Journal of Early American Life, Dress, and MacGuffin, the Life of Things. Welcome to the show, Hannah.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's so great to be here.
Thank you so much for making time to be here. I know your class has just started. What are you teaching this quarter?
Well, it's the first semester sophomores who are coming into the apparel department at the Rhode Island School of Design. And so I'm trying to convince them that reading and context and research is going to really help support their studio practice. So the class is Histories of Dress.
We are so happy to have you here. Regular listeners of this podcast know that I tend to gravitate towards fiction, but I tore through Pockets and I found it utterly riveting. So my first question is, why the subject of pockets?
Besides feeling disgruntled about not having enough pockets, I just became really interested in this notion of, you know, hasty exits that Robinson Crusoe talks about. So I was teaching a class on Robinsonades and the subsequent literature of castaways. And there's a scene in Robinson Crusoe that we've all forgotten, but that was quite infamous in the 1720s. It was called Defoe's Notorious Blunder. And it revolved around a continuity problem that was very revealing to me. A man could strip on a shore and have a skinny dip and do that purposefully, but absentmindedly expect to have his pockets at his disposal. So in the actual book, Crusoe strips so he can swim to his foundering ship and save some supplies. And his critics gleefully made fun of the passage, the famous passage of his swimming to shore naked with his pockets full of biscuits. So I just love that pockets are so naturalized, that dependable in menswear, that you could actually still expect to have pockets while you were swimming back from the boat.
Unless we miss the memo and he's marsupial.
Exactly. And so I did have a little field day with that question of marsupials and discovered that Thomas Carlyle, who writes the first sort of serious discussion of fashion in his Tailor Retailer, says, you know, the reason to wear clothes is because we are not marsupial. We don't have pouches attached to our bodies. We are these humans with terribly tight skin. There's nothing useful on our bodies. So we are not marsupial mammals. This is why we have to wear clothes. So I love that notion. And then I kept discovering all sorts of mentions in literature. Pockets are used in literature to sort of suggest what resources a character has available and something about who they are and their real secrets and who they hope to be.
I didn't know about that literary blunder until I read your book. So that was a very interesting fact to learn. What was most striking to me in your book are the ways in which pockets act as a sort of microcosm for power inequity throughout history. Can you speak to that in a bit more detail?
Sure. I think, you know, some traditions that are gendered in clothing seem really arbitrary. Have you ever noticed that women's wear buttons have buttons placed on the right and men's wear buttons have buttons on the left? And, you know, I might actually have that wrong, but it seems like an arbitrary but harmless sort of tradition. But pockets really are not harmless. And I wanted to explore why a straightforward functional element of dress is gendered. You know, without pockets, you are not equipped for the real contest, as Toad says in Wind in the Willows in 1895. And people were commenting on this division between pockets and purses, have done so for a long time. The design historian Adrian Forty, quite a while ago, said, gendered characteristics don't exist as realities, but as ideas. And to live comfortably with them, though, we need evidence of their truth. And something like some garment like clothing is that kind of evidence.
How has your occupation informed writing this book?
I wanted to be a conservator. And early on in my career, I hoped to work with objects and to safeguard them. And I trained to be a conservator of textiles and garments. But it was in the middle of that training where a mentor said to me, I don't know, Hannah, I think you might be a researcher. And she didn't see, but I had this huge curved needle and I was trying to sew gimp onto this 1854 couch. And gimp is that decorative sort of braiding that goes along where the couch meets the wood. And I was bleeding terribly. And she said, you really just don't have the hand skills, you know, like, and it was really one of those moments where you have that awful moment of realization, but a new door opened up and I thought, I could actually tell stories about objects and our relationships to them. And I could try that instead. And so that's what I did.
I'm going to have to use the word gimp in a sentence in the next week to keep it in my vocabulary. I have a master's degree in Victorian literature, which is a time rife with secret keeping. And there is this dichotomy between the private and the public sphere, which I learned through your book. It's almost mirrored through fashion. And I hadn't really ever thought about this in relation to fashion at the times before, but I couldn't stop thinking about it while I was reading your book. As a person who loves a period piece, I loved reading about all of the historical and cultural significance that pockets provided. Can you give listeners maybe just a bite-sized fun fact or two about the history of pockets?
Sure. I would love to. It's, I think what happened a little bit is that once I started looking, I saw pockets everywhere. Have you ever been on a bus and looked around and noticed that everyone has a nose and started thinking, oh my God, that's so crazy. Same sort of thing happened when I thought, oh, where can I find information about pockets? And they just show up everywhere. But I think really surprising to me was that I could actually go all the way back to the 16th century to the period when pockets are included. And instead of being considered a nifty device, pockets were actually considered threatening space. As you say, they were private. And this was really alarming. And it was alarming because the new technology, which allowed hand size, small scale weapons and the first handguns meant that you could now carry these really dangerous weapons on your person and that it wouldn't be seen. And so I found proclamations and sort of laws that tried to limit the use of pocket scaled pistols. Note that the pistols are called pocket pistols sort of from the get-go. And then the amazing discussions of this first assassination of a political leader by a handgun. The leader was William the Silent. He was Dutch. And witnesses were just sort of shocked that that the assassin was not this brave guy carrying a big sword and, you know, wasn't obviously threatening. Instead, the assassin walked up to the prince and reached into his pocket as if he was about to draw out a letter to show him, and instead drew out this gun and shot him. And people were horrified and considered it sort of unmanly that you could now, you know, rely on a covert weapon rather than being obviously brave. So I was just amazed that you know, it's not this newfangled, interesting object. It's really a sort of threatening place at first.
I'm so glad you picked that example. I actually read that part about the pocket pistols to my family because I was so fascinated by it.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
And finally, you've included fashion, historical references, art, theater references, documentation, photos of historical items that were made to fit in pockets, cultural critique, and of course, as you began, there are just so many wonderful literary references throughout your book. How did you tackle the vast research required of this book?
I just started and it just kept going. I often tell stories with pictures, and so it was natural for me to want to show all the evidence I could and try to convince people that I want to convince you that this is as interesting and weird as I'm finding it. And I think images do that. I think research has to happen. It just has to be as broad as it can be to make a case. I should say that the only reason I could write this book is because of databases and this unbelievable amount of historical evidence that we have that is now searchable by keyword. Mm-hmm. So everyone now can look at early English books online, for example, which catalogs all the printed material, you know, starting in something like the earliest ones are 1540, I think, and including manuscript pages. And I could search for the word and all the derivations of the word pocket and all of its spellings and see where it shows up in literature. Had I not had that tool, I think you would have had to spend, you know, decades in the archive to actually suss any of that out, because it's not going to be cataloged as an important part of any one document. But as you move through and catalog where it shows up, it suggests that everybody talked about it at some point, just that it wasn't an important thing. And so the only way to find these seemingly unimportant mentions, I think, is that the ability we have now to use these incredible databases.
Well, thank you for answering all of my questions about pockets, an intimate history of how we keep things close. And now it's time to move on to the books.
My first recommendation is Elizabeth Wayland Barber's The Mummies of Urumichi. And this is an amazing book about just the early history of textiles and clothing. Barber is an archaeologist and a linguist, and she takes us on this crazy trip across continents to discover how cloth and clothing are so significant to our language and our way of thinking and the way we use tools. She was an archaeologist who was the first to pay attention to the tools of textile technology. And through those tools, she maps migrations of people. And it's so fascinating. This is a book that's not her academic book, and I think that makes it even more fun. And it's a specific mystery story. It's why this twill ends up in Turfan in China, a twill that's associated with this mountains range in Germany or something. That's not exactly correct. But all I'm saying is that it takes you wide and far and start to see that reevaluate cloth and clothing for the human experience. And that book is Elizabeth Wayland Barber's The Mummies of Urumichi.
My first pick is Happiness Falls by Angie Kim, and this came out on August 29th. And Angie Kim is the author of the very popular Miracle Creek, which I somehow never read, but after reading Happiness Falls, I'm definitely going to go back and check it out. This book is a suspense mystery novel, and it's 20-year-old Mia's story of the day her dad disappeared. She has a twin brother and a 14-year-old brother, Eugene, who has Engelmann syndrome. Mia is biracial, she's white and Korean, and the morning of her father's disappearance, Eugene and his dad go out for a hike to River Falls Park, a place they visit often. But something is definitely wrong when Eugene comes running out of the park, almost getting hit by a car, and he returns home bloody. Mia is getting all of her information secondhand, and she, along with the rest of her family, are trying to put the pieces together. One major hurdle is that Eugene is nonverbal. In addition to surprising plot twists, what makes this book a knockout is Mia's voice. She's smart and contemplative, and Angie Kim puts footnotes to good use, although I found them a little tough to navigate reading them on my Kindle. This is a book about family and secrets and language, and I highly recommend this one for readers who enjoy mysteries with younger protagonists. Thank you to Random House and to NetGalley for the advanced review copy. And again, that's Happiness Falls by Angie Kim. Hannah, what is your second pick?
My second pick is Carolyn Weber's Queen of Fashion. I think maybe one of the best books about fashion and how it can be deployed by women that I've ever read. It's the book that Coppola used for her film. I think that was a 2008 film, but the book itself is such a lovely sort of discussion of culture and its connection to fashion. And she looks at everything from the poofs, the huge hair. Weber argues that the reason that Marie Antoinette, who had no power, but when she had not yet conceived of any children, she used fashion to claim that power. And one thing she did was have fashion these enormous wigs, which became the style all throughout Europe and North America. And details like that make it just fascinating. So that's the Carolyn Weber's Queen of Fashion.
There's a new series, a new Marie Antoinette on PBS. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I binged the whole thing. I loved it. My second pick does not have to do with fashion, but it does have a connection to beauty, and it's called Rouge by Mona Awad, and this comes out tomorrow. Awad is the author of Bunny and All's Well. She never fails to deliver dark gothic vibes, and Rouge is no exception. In this novel, derived from fairy tales, the disturbing dark versions, of course, Belle's mother dies after falling from a cliff. Belle flies in from Montreal, where she runs a store, a clothing store, to attend the funeral. Her mother also used to run a store in La Jolla, California, with her sister. Her mother was obsessed with beauty, and when a mysterious woman in red shows up at her mom's funeral, Belle learns that her mom was a guest at the Maison de Meduse, a beauty club of sorts. But all is not as it seems at the Maison de Meduse, and Belle must go down her own rabbit hole if she wants to uncover what happened to her mother. This is a dark, surreal novel that ruminates on beauty and mother-daughter relationships. It's filled with Awad's signature haunting writing. It was a fun read for me personally because my parents are from Montreal and we live in Southern California, and this book kind of bounces back between those two locales. It's weird, it's dark, and it's called Rouge by Mona Awad. Hannah, what's your last pick?
My last pick has nothing to do with fashion, and it's a little bit more about where I'm from, where I live now, which is Rhode Island, and it's William Finnegan's Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. So it also is a one-object book, but in this case, it's a man and a surfboard, and it's his sort of coming of age and life story, and the most gorgeous writing about waves, being in the water, you know, being a body and forgetting yourself in the water. He's an unbelievably accomplished and writes for The New Yorker and all sorts of places, but prose is so lucid and so gorgeous. And if you ever want to forget the world and think about water, I highly recommend it. And again, William Finnegan, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life.
Sounds fantastic. Next up for me is Pet by Katherine Chitke. Hannah, what's sitting on your bookshelf waiting to be read?
I cannot wait to read The New Zadie Smith. I can't help it.
Oh, me too. I'm dying to read it. Do you have it yet?
No, I'm third online at the library, and I don't know if I can wait.
I was thinking this week I need to go out and get a copy. I'm dying to read it. Well, your book may be too big to fit in my pocket, but I plan on keeping it on my bookshelf and wowing people with all of my newfound pocket knowledge and using the word GIMP as often as possible. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today.
I have just so enjoyed this conversation. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
All of the books we talked about today, including Pockets, An Intimate History of How We Keep Things Close by Hannah Carlson, can be found in the show notes and link up to my Books Are My People bookstore. Don't forget to enter my The Weaver and the Witch giveaway on Instagram. And in the meantime, I hope you all have a wonderfully bookish week.